Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. Today, I'm going to look really at 19th and early 20th century British labour history. And I stress, this is an overview. I can't possibly do this very, very deep and varied subject justice in one sort of half hour, 20 minutes to half an hour podcast. But I'm going to give you the broad brush strokes here. Now, the reason why I'm doing this is because it's going to help you to navigate this issue an awful lot more, skillfully. If I give you kind of a succinct overview from 1832 to the eve of the First World War. Okay. Obviously, the kind of the masterwork on this subject, the bedrock of British labour history, really is E.P. Thompson's *The Making of the English Working Class*, which is well worth a read. Obviously, it's a Marxist historiography, and E.P. Thompson comes at it from his own ideological positions. That doesn't discount it as a really thorough work of history, and the idea of the kind of the formation of class in there is very well articulated. If we were to rewind to 1815, the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars for Britain isn't entirely good. You have a prolonged economic slump, exacerbated by waves of demobbed and very often impoverished and wounded soldiers. There's a climate of poverty really up till the kind of the mid-1820s. And there's a big upswing in protest at the time. Much of it is partly motivated by the fact that traditional industries are in decline, traditional kind of craft and artisan trades are in decline, and there is the rise of manufacturing. It's at this period of time that you have phenomena such as Luddism, where supposedly the kind of the apocryphal Ned Ludd smashed machinery in a cotton mill in order to destroy the kind of the pernicious effect of manufacturing, which is stealing jobs from ordinary men. There probably was no Ned Ludd, but it spread like the, you know, the 19th century equivalent of a Facebook meme, with people across the north of England imitating Ludd's activities, and the Luddites were the kind of destroyers of modern manufacturing technology. The other main incident of the time is the Peterloo Massacre in Manchester, where peaceful protesters demanding better conditions for the workers and better representation were mercilessly cut down by mounted soldiers. So there is a climate from 1815 to the 1820s of a fear of revolution. Obviously, Britain has spent 20 years fighting revolutionary wars in France, and it's very mindful that there's a climate of perhaps renewed revolution in the air. The continent sees a series of revolutionary upheavals, between 1815 and 1848. There's almost consistent revolution on the continent, and the British are determined to try to insulate the British Isles from this revolutionary threat. And so the result of this is that the actual response towards workers organising themselves is normally quite draconian. One only needs to look at, in the 1830s, the case of the Tolpuddle Martyrs, who organise a trade union in their village and are transported to Australia. Not so much for organising a trade union. The legal pretext for transporting them was that they were involved in some kind of conspiracy, i.e. that they had a secret, supposedly in inverted commas, secret meeting, which was simply a meeting in one of the organisers' homes. And that this was the pretext for suggesting that they were involved in some kind of conspiracy to overthrow the state, hence their deportation. And the result of the Tolpuddle Martyrs' deportation is a mass procession through London of 800,000 members of the new working class to protest this. And that alone, I think, was the thing that prompted the government to have them brought back eventually. Because, you see, by 1851, in point of fact, Britain hosts the Great Exhibition. She is the workshop of the world. Britain has had the first industrial revolution, and she leads the way in terms of engineering, construction, things such as the new railways, new iron ships, the large infrastructure projects that we later are synonymous with the Victorian era. And the result of this, with kind of Britain's four main staple industries of cotton, coal, shipbuilding and iron and steel, see the explosion of an urban working class. You have cities such as Manchester and Sheffield, or Cardiff where I am at the moment, go through this metamorphosis from being, in many ways, tiny hamlets in about 1750 to being vast industrial complexes less than a century later. The Industrial Revolution sucks people from the countryside and sucks people from the peripheries of the British Isles, particularly from Ireland, right into the hearts of cities, crams them into large, poorly created slum dwellings thrown up by factory owners, and where there is little oversight or regulation of anything, any of the staples of life, such as Clean Air Acts and that kind of thing, come in the 1870s, sanitation, or anything like that. You know, the problems of infant mortality are present in all these situations, and in general, working conditions for this new working class are pretty abysmal. And so it is little wonder that a sense of class identity in shared adversity develops very quickly. And by the 1850s, it's clear that this new working class presents a profound challenge to the established political system of liberal and Tory. If we rewind again, sorry about the back and forward nature of this podcast, but if we rewind back to the 1832 Reform Act, the 1832 Reform Act was Britain's attempt, really, to preempt the possibility of revolution. The need for reform was present in most of the constituencies up and down the country. The boundaries of constituencies hadn't really changed much, pretty much since the Civil War. Therefore, you found constituencies such as Manchester with no MPs, and then certain parts of rural Suffolk with half a dozen, where ultimately there were one MP for every 100 or one or 200 constituents. So the people who needed representing the most, the new urban working class, had no representation. And desire on the part of the working class was to have some, and the new middle class, as it became exceedingly wealthy from the Industrial Revolution, was to have adequate representation. Obviously, the landed gentry, whose party, the Conservative Party, were adamant that they would not sacrifice any of their political power, the MP of the period was typically a gentleman who didn't draw any kind of salary, but simply lived off his investments, his trust fund, his land, and would from there be able to dabble in the gentlemanly sport of politics, which would of course keep him and his class's interests nice and secure. The upshot of 1832 is that the middle classes, Britain's sort of growing bourgeoisie, are the ones who are enfranchised. They're the ones that get the vote, as vote has a property qualification. People with properties over a certain value may have the franchise. And it was seen that a responsible, respectable type of fellow who could earn enough to keep a household and to have a property could be trusted with such issues as voting. The working classes go with continued disenfranchisement, and it's not shortly after that. It's shortly after that that actually the situation becomes worse for the working classes, because the new middle classes, who are now having their input into the system of power, and predominantly their vote goes towards the Liberals, see policies forwarded that really are profoundly adverse to the working classes, particularly things like the new poor laws and the Natural Act, which establishes workhouses. Ideas such as the fecklessness of the working classes, and the ideas relating to the working classes, their idleness, their debauchedness, and their poverty, became far more prevalent after the 1832 Act than before them. And the workhouses, the new workhouses, sought to punish this idleness and to almost criminalise it, and to make life so unpleasant within the workhouse, where you had to live, if you were going to live off the parish, that you would buck your ideas up and do a hard day's graft when you left. Obviously, we now know in the 21st century that the causes of poverty are entirely more complex, but this was an idea that was ripe for its times, and put forward predominantly not by the landed gentry, but by the new urban industrial bourgeoisie, the winners from the Industrial Revolution. In 1838, London Working Men's Association first signs and creates the first People's Charter, and this is the beginnings of the Chartist movement, of which there is roughly the supposed peaceful branch of Chartism under the auspices of William Lovett and Francis Place, and a more militant, perhaps revolutionary Chartism under the auspices of Fergus O'Connor, about more whom later. The People's Charter is submitted to Parliament in 1838, 1842 and 1848. And in 1842 there are actually 3.5 million signatories. In each case, the charter is rebuffed. There are a couple of violent insurrections by the Chartists, particularly at the Westgate Hotel in Newport in South Wales. Living in South Wales, one does have a kind of a very powerful sense of the contribution really that the Chartists made towards the kind of the birth of mass democracy in the start of the 20th century. Even though the Chartists by 1848 have largely failed to have the People's Charter which demanded universal suffrage, elections every year, and paid MPs, among other things. Even though it's been rebuffed three times by Parliament, the People's Charter by 1848 had achieved some considerable things. Firstly, in 1848, across Europe, there are actually European-wide revolutions. The working classes in Britain are looked upon with a great deal of fear and suspicion, and the ruling classes, really throughout the rest of the 19th century, are exceedingly mindful that they can't do exactly what they want when they want with the lower orders, and they do have to find some way of incorporating their need for representation into the mainstream. And the combination of the People's Charter and this sense of potential revolutionary anger from below mean that by 1867 and 1883, the franchise has been extended really to cover a wide bulk of the kind of the artisan and respectable working class, and the unskilled working classes are finally.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Given the vote in the Representation of the People Act 1918, along with the majority of women, and finally in 1928, all women, all individuals over the age of 18 are enfranchised. So the Chartists didn't succeed outright, but their legacy is exceedingly important, and really they are the kind of the godfathers, if you will, of British mass democracy. The thing to note about 1848 as well is that it is a period, you know, within, as I said, within the by the early 1850s, Britain is industrially on top of the world, the dominant world industrial power. So by 1848, there had been a profound upswing in the economy, and the need for perhaps militancy, for militant action, seemed less pronounced in the minds of the working class, who had a bit of money in their pockets and perhaps less financial insecurity. From the 1850s through to the 1870s, there is a new mood of unionism. All of the energies that had gone into Chartism shift towards unionism. There is the people, the working classes who demand a People's Charter don't simply cease to exist after 1848. They go somewhere else, and particularly the artisan working class. By artisan, I mean these are skilled workers. These are people who have who command a higher wage because their skills in things like engraving or manufacture or dyeing or carpentry or what have you are hard to come by and thus can command a higher wage. And these were the main constituents, the main constituents of unions up until the mid-1870s and 1880s. After the 1880s, there is a surge of unskilled labour into the unions, and this has a profoundly altering effect. The thing about the artisan working class is that they very often didn't see themselves as having an awful lot in common with their unskilled cousins who make up the bulk of the working class, and often saw themselves as in many ways a cut above and perhaps having slightly more in common with their employers and having maybe a little bit more time for their employers. The working classes after the 1880s, the unions after the 1880s, increase in size, largely due to the fact that Gladstone had made unionism, given it fully recognised legal status in the 1870s, and thus that meant that the trade unions were less likely to face litigation from employers if they went on strike. The best example of new unionism, as it was called, was the Bryant and May Match Girls strike in 1888, where the Match Girls who worked at the Bryant and May factory and who were treated abominably, were dealt all manner of kind of petty and ritual humiliations by their male overseers, were very often fell ill because of the white phosphorus that they were working with, which got into their bones and caused all sorts of deformities. They went on strike for better pay and a shorter working day, and eventually they win. These were unskilled labourers who were self-organising. There was a lot has been said about Annie Besant, who was one of the kind of the original organisers of the strike, who comes from outside, is well educated and politically aware. The thing that has come to light in recent historiographies of the Match Girls strike is that Annie Besant's role isn't quite what people think, or quite as important as people think, because the Match Girls were actually doing things for themselves, organising themselves. So the reason why the Match Girls strike is significant is because it is a strike by non-artisan labour. It's a strike by unskilled labour that's successful, and it sets a precedent for further union action in England, and the numbers of strikes and strike days increases in the 1880s and 1890s as more and more non-artisan, unskilled manufacturing labour decide that it is time to flex their muscles and they develop the confidence to do so. So from the 1880s, really through to the 1920s, there is a prolonged period of union militancy and a big upsurge in union strength. And throughout this period, in fact, actually, we're going to do another rewind. If we go back almost to the 1860s, the Liberals and the Conservatives had both, in many ways, from the 1860s through to the 1880s, looked upon the emergence of working class politics not so much as with a sense of horror, but with a sense of inevitability. They could see it on the way, and the period of Gladstone's first administration in the 1870s is a period of social reform. Gladstone was motivated by his own kind of Christian nonconformist beliefs, believing that really the working man should have some kind of fair deal from the riches of the Industrial Revolution. But he was also motivated by savvy political considerations, looking at social reform in terms as a thing that would eventually stave off Labour politics and divert this new growing potential constituency of the working classes towards seeing the Liberals as their natural party. Disraeli was profoundly anti-reform until obviously he got into power after Gladstone, and from then onwards in Disraeli's administration of the 1870s, he saw his role again as trying to siphon off the energies of the new working classes, and he wanted to create something like a working class conservatism, and for the working class to see the Tories as their natural patrons. And what eventually happens, of course, is that after World War One, we see really the rise of a Labour Party. In the decade before the First World War, we see another period of social reform by the Liberals, particularly led by Lloyd George, who brings matters to a head with the People's Budget of 1909, where he essentially, in order to get the budget passed to pay for social reform, including old age pensions, and to finance the building of dreadnoughts at the same time to counter the growing threat of German naval rivalries, has to impose a super tax on the wealthy, and eventually have a series of general elections to break the power of the House of Lords and their ability to veto. That's a story for another time. One of the final things I want to talk about is the extent of Labour militancy on the eve of World War One. By 1911, there was a genuine fear that there would be a revolution in Britain. The unions were explicitly articulating this, but not the union leadership. Much of the rank and file of the trade unions looked at the union leadership with a kind of distrust and disdain. The leaders of the country's biggest unions were, in the eyes of some of the rank and file, little better than bosses themselves. They'd become wealthy and gentrified and had, you know, comparatively cosy relations with the management of some of Britain's major industries. So the result of that was a radicalism from below. And it's interesting that if you skip forward to the mid to late 1970s, you see a replay of this, really, in things like the Winter of Discontent, where the union bosses seem to have completely lost control of the rank and file membership, who and the shop stewards, who became progressively more radical. The emergence of syndicalism before World War One was an extremely worrying trend to the union leadership and also to the government, who were mindful that this could possibly break out into mass civil unrest. And the Liberal government at the time is facing a possible civil war in Ireland, and the prospect even of the suffragettes putting bombs in the mail, as they had started to do. I think when the suffragettes burned down Lloyd George's house, it was a bit of a clue. And in a way, tragic though it is to say, the saviour of Liberal England is the outbreak of war in the summer of 1914. Because this vast seeming external threat to the country and this rallying call to arms does take the wind and take the energy out of much of the kind of the internal unrest. But anyway, I've gone on far too long. So as I said, that was a kind of a broad overview, broad brushstrokes, which should help to kind of, when you're looking at it in looking at Labour history in a synoptic sense, give you a kind of a general picture. But it does impress upon people who think about this how fundamental Labour history has been to the dynamics of the creation of modern politics in Britain, and also that it's really we look upon British Labour politics as a thing of the Victorian era, but really it's a thing that really dates back before the Napoleonic Wars in many ways. So, anyway, just a couple of quick announcements before we finish up today. Firstly, the Communist Century by Chris Kostov is going to be ready to download, hopefully in the next month. It's a brilliant, as we've done today, it's a brilliant synoptic overview in 35,000 words on the history of communism in the 20th century, from Russia to China to Cuba to Vietnam to Angola and beyond, and the challenge of anti-communism. So it's well worth downloading. If you're studying modern British history or politics, it's an essential handbook that you can keep. Chris Kostov is a superb academic who's come to work with Explaining History, and it's going to be a pleasure to see this and hopefully more work from him in the future. Julia Routledge's George Orwell biography is going to be joined with another title by her in the next couple of months, the Genocidal Century, which is going to look at everything from the Armenian Genocide through to the Holocaust through to Rwanda, and try to look at the big picture of why we've been in this century of genocide. My very own Redson at War Part 3 is ready to download. It's the third instalment of Japan's War in the Pacific. And if you're interested in that, then there is a great title that's coming out later in the year. William McSweeney's The Destructive Century, looking at the kind of the mass industrialisation of warfare, mass bombing, and how war has gone from being the sport of gentlemen in about the 17th century to really being, you know, this profound threat to the continuance of humanity. So we've got loads going on. This is I'm always looking for new writers, always looking for new contributors. So if you really want to make that leap into writing, see your works published either on the site or in ebook format, drop me a line at info@explaininghistory.com or visit the site www.explaininghistory.com. And I want as many people out there to be part of this great history conversation that we've got going on. Anyway, thanks very much. Do remember to visit the site. We're actually... One other thing, we've got a new essay on there by Tom Layton, all about Stalin's adoption of socialism in one country. So anyway, until the next time, I've waited on for long enough. Have a good one. Speak to you soon. Bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.